Welcome back, everybody. This is the second in our coverage on the TV podcast of The Expanse on Sci-Fi. Doing it a little differently. We're not doing this episode by episode, at least not so far. But we did watch episodes 2 through 4 of The Expanse. Our first episode was about the pilot, which we watched before it even aired, because it was on the internet, on streaming. And then, of course, when episode 1 dropped, episodes 2, 3, and 4 appeared digitally, which I don't know what they're doing, but I love it. I hope that by the time that this episode is released, they have released the entire season randomly on the web, because why not? Maybe just drop the finale now, but we won't understand anything that happens in it. Anyway, it's very confusing what they're doing. But we watched 3 episodes, and now we're going to talk about all 3 episodes sort of as a whole. So you need to have watched the first 4 episodes of The Expanse to listen to this podcast, or you'll be horribly spoiled. Joining me to talk about it are a fine panel of Expanse viewers. Aline Sims, hello.
Hello.
Erica Ensign, hi.
Hi.
Not on the Sci-Fi Channel in Canada. It's on Space.
No,
right?
I watched it on space.com.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Is it space.com? It can't be. It's got to be like space.ca or something.
It's probably space.ca.
Or space.com.
I don't know.
I think space.com, you'd be watching like SpaceX launches and
probably.
And Mars
I made
probes.
Steven pull it up, so I didn't actually do the work. I'm that lazy.
Brian Hamilton, hello.
How's it going? Hi.
Welcome to this TV podcast. The furniture's a little different on this one. Tony Sindler, hi.
Hello, nerds.
Yay, it's Tony.
Hi.
And Joseph Rosensteel. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so The Big Empty, Remember the Cant, and CQB are the 3 episodes that we watched for this, which as we post this episode, we'll have just aired episode 4, so we'll be very current with The Expanse. And it was suggested moments before we began recording that we discuss this sort of Game of Thrones style, not in the sense that everybody dies, but in the sense that we follow the storylines. And I think that's not a bad way to go. If people want to call out specific things to specific episodes, I think that's great. But some of us may not even remember what happens in what episode. And so that's also okay.
I'm raising my hand.
Yeah.
Yep. I watch them all at once.
Yeah, so that's all. That's perfectly fine too. Where should we? Let's start. So one of the things that I got feedback about our last episode is that we spent a lot of time comparing the books to the show, and I want to do a little bit of that, but you know, I don't want to have this become the compare books to TV show podcast. Also, a shout out. He's probably not listening to this one, but Daniel Abraham, one of the writers of the Expanse series, listened to our first episode.
Wait, what? Wow.
Uh huh. Okay.
So that was interesting. But he's probably not listening now. And he said that his feedback was that yes, he does know. They do know where the season is going to end, because we speculated about that, what part of the book the season's going to end with. And I think it's very clear from the pace of these 4 episodes that it's not going to end anywhere remotely close to the end of the book, the first
no
book
way.
Of the series.
Yeah, no way.
It's a much more slow-paced plot that's being dished out here. So maybe they learn from Game of Thrones a little bit to slow it down. I don't know. Episode 2 is kind of boring.
Yep.
I do remember that about episode 2.
At least it's not 9 episodes of sitting in a shuttle. that would have been one way to pace the series.
That would have.
Do we know how many episodes they're doing this season?
I think they're 10.
10. Mm, there we go.
I think. Hmm.
Yes.
I heard they're 10, although the Wikipedia page only shows 9. Wikipedia page. So I don't know.
Oh yeah, it does.
Whether they're doing 9 episodes or whether they're doing 10 episodes or 10 hours, maybe episode 9 is 2 hours, I don't know. It's a mystery. But Joe, I think you commented on this. I know we had this conversation about it. Episode 2, I just said, by the way, that we're going to follow plot threads and now we're going to talk about an episode specifically, but this is the TV podcast. I'm all over the place. Episode 2 I thought was really boring because it is them kind of like fixing the antenna on their shuttle. That's like the whole episode of episode 2. And there's so much that happens. Episode 3 and especially episode 4 are so exciting. And the pacing of this, it seems so strange to me. And it almost got me thinking that when they were plotting out what the story they wanted to tell in this first season, they kind of didn't have enough story when they pulled it apart. And they thought, we could do a whole episode about them fixing the antenna.
Yeah, and I don't know, even as someone who's invested in the show, I was kind of like, okay, why do I care about this? Because I'm invested in my interpretation of the characters in the books and not the characters on the TV show yet, if that makes sense. And mm-hmm. So I'm watching it and I'm like, because they're still disassociated. They're not, you know, as we've talked about, like Amos is not the guy I thought he was, you know, I thought he would. So they're not the same characters to me yet. And I was like, why am I supposed to care at this point? I could see that being like a cliffhanger episode later on or a suspenseful episode once there's some emotional investment. But I was just like, eh.
I mean, I guess the argument would be that this is a crucible that these characters are put in and you learn things about them. But I can see the other argument here, which is these are not people we really know very well. So why do we care about?
Yeah, in regards to it being a crucible where we could pull out information and interesting things, like, did anyone get anything interesting other than Naomi is smart?
They like Naomi better than they like Holden.
Yeah.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's all I got out of the whole shuttle experience, which is, I think, unfortunate.
Oh, I would say we also get that Amos is willing to be as pragmatically violent as he wants to be. I did get, there's that night scene when he and Holden are outside in space and he's basically got a wrench and is like, I can kill you right now. And I was like, okay, well, that is effective in explaining Amos to us. But that was about it.
Yes, I found myself in the odd position that, you know, I read the book, but it was long enough ago that I don't remember it all that well. Like, I'm finding that I remember it even less than I thought I did after the last TV podcast, because you guys were reminding me things, and I was like, oh, I did not remember that at all. And so I'm still in a weird sort of halfway position where a few things I remember, and then I can tell that it's different, and then most of the stuff that's happening on the screen, in my head, I'm like, okay, did this happen this way in the book? Am I, or not? And they changed it. I cannot remember. So I've been working to just kind of forget about the books. like don't try to remember what was happening in the books anymore, because I'm never going to be able to come up with it the way that it happened without rereading the book. And I if I do reread the book and it's all fresh, then I'm just going to spend the entire time picking it apart and noticing what the differences were. So my goal now, and I think I got better as these episodes went on, my goal is to just kind of forget what little I know from the books and focus on it simply as its own thing. It is the TV show. I don't need to compare it to anything else. Yeah. I may not even read the rest of the books until after the entire series is done. So I'm finding I'm liking it better the more I can just give up on the whole book side of things altogether.
You know, I don't read many books, and I did the Game of Thrones podcast, and I've been watching Game of Thrones since the very beginning of the show. But this is the first time that I'm seeing something I've read being adapted into something like this. We talked about this a little bit earlier, and it's so weird to have these things that I read 2 months ago now being reinterpreted right in front of me. You're right. I don't think Amos is the same person I thought that that he would be in the books. I mean, all I can hear now is Jefferson Mays' audiobook that I was listening to the whole time. But all of these things that are so different, I am trying to separate myself from them, because all I'm going to be doing this whole time, and we're going to try not to make this podcast all of this, but I'm trying to not you know, bring in the baggage from the book that I have now that I've read them.
Well, and something that I noticed talking about the book so much is that I think that part of the issue I was having in the beginning with like the ages of the characters and that kind of thing is because it's been a year since I've read the first book. And, you know, I just finished the last book, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago. So I'm like several years into the future in the book timeline. And I think that was kind of coloring my like or dislike of some of the casting decisions.
Yeah, similar experience. I read the last one, Nemesis Games, this summer, and I just started reading The Churn after our first podcast, where it was recommended by Dan Morin and Jason Snell as being interesting.
Yeah.
Thing about that was it was even more of like a, this is totally not the same Amos. I stopped reading it.
Aw.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the same guy.
No.
All right, we're talking about our friends who are the last survivors of the Canterbury out in space. We ought to probably just follow that along. We get them in their shuttle lifeboat that was never meant to be a lifeboat after the cant is blown up, and they do have to fix the antenna. I'm trying to make that as insulting a plot point as possible when I describe it. I need to find ways to make it even seem a little more. I mean, it's important. It's like they need to call for help because they're running out of air, and it's sort of dramatic, but you know, it's also kind of boring. But then the big surprise is that then there's a Martian warship bearing down on them, and Holden broadcasts an accusation that the Martians are behind what's going on the blowing up of the Canterbury, because they found a Martian battery or something, you know, a Martian made.
It was the transponder.
Transponder. Yeah, well, it's the battery. In the book, it's the battery and the transponder, but either way. I can't remember the details, but it's Martian made. It's an alarm clock from Mars that they found, and they're like, aha, I accuse you.
They're well-made alarm clocks, so.
And then they're brought aboard a Martian warship and interrogated. And then in episode 4, everything basically goes to hell. And the stealth ships that are presumably related to the plot that's happening on Earth, these stealth ships attack the Martian warship. And it is a really, I found it in the book too, but in the TV show, I found it a delightful turn of events. And my wife, who's not read the books, did too, that you begin by being so intimidated by this huge Martian warship, and these guys are on their rinky dink little shuttle. And by the end of episode 4, the Martian warship has been blown up and they have fled in a different ship. It's quite a swing, and it's and very exciting, but they're in a very different place at the end of episode 4 than they are at the beginning of episode 2.
What I find weird is that in the second episode, they did what was effectively a bottle episode for the for survivors of the Cant. And if they were going to do something like that, where all they did was fix the antenna and did a few other things, they should have focused more on the characters. And they did. That's mm-hmm. what they were trying to do, I think. But they could have done a bit more. Like, we get Holden's broadcast. We get, what else? Amos saying, I can kill you with this wrench. And Naomi being smart and awesome. And that's all we get. And as important as those things are, if they're going to spend an entire episode doing that, they could have done more.
I feel like they could have done a more exciting episode with them locked up in the brig on the Martian ship. And
see,
like,
I thought that was better
than
the second episode.
Like, well, I feel like, you know, if they want to do a bottle episode, I think that would have been cool. Was like, we are locked in jail and we have to talk about what's going on and who we are and sort this out. And that might have been more exciting than we're just on the ship and we have to fix the MacGuffin so that we can proceed, because space is scary.
A 3-hour tour, mm-hmm. Tony.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, would we all think of the Mars warship stuff? It's I think if you don't know anything about the story, you're thinking, well, where are these people going to end up? Are we going to be on this Martian warship for a while? Whereas if you've read the book, you're like, oh, they're so doomed.
Right.
But you know, what did everybody think about those sequences? We meet the captain. There's a lot of Earth Belter or Earth Mars and Mars Belter kind of animosity that we see. The animosity mm-hmm. toward Holden is really interesting. Whereas Alex, being a veteran of the Mars Navy, is like not even held with them. There's a lot of interesting dynamics going on that ship.
I loved the captain. I was very surprised to see such a cool captain who is a woman of color. And I was just like, yeah, you rock. And just the whole way through, at first I'm super intimidated. And then there's, it's not like the character softens in any way, but manages to just keep this, you know, ramrod straight spine all the way through. But at the end, ends up having to make a really tough decision. And it's just, it was, yeah, that was the part of that. I appreciated the tiny bit of bottle episode we got between the characters themselves. But I found that my attention was mostly drawn by this one character who then ends up biting it in the end, as I knew she would. But yeah, I liked the character stuff we got from everybody, but that the bridge scenes were the ones that tantalized me the most.
Yeah. I was really distracted by her bottle of, or her thing of tea.
It was water.
Yeah,
it was a clear thermos bottle of water
was
the whole entire time.
It looked brown.
They wanted to tie it in, I think, really heavy-handedly to the whole, like, we're sending
Canterbury
resources away and et cetera. I didn't really particularly think it was worth having her hold it the whole entire time. Although I did quite like her character, like Erica said.
I liked it only because I liked it as a touch of, like, these are actual people who are, like, just doing their job. And I also think it said something about the almost the casualness of the and arrogance of the Martian Navy. They're like, they're the big dogs. There is nothing that is going to threaten them at all. They're just hanging out. She's drinking her water out of her water bottle. It's just another day. Right. When if you've read the books, especially, you know, it's not just another day, but it sort of sets that scene of like it's so I like that about it. And one of the things I've liked in all these episodes is this feeling like the ships are lived in and they do their jobs and they're not, you know, they don't feel shiny and whizzy futury. They feel like these are, you know, places where people work and it seems plausible. So her having the zero G water bottle basically seemed reasonable to me. I thought it was OK. Didn't bother me.
Going off of that.
I was just going to say the one other brief futuristic thing was I like the magnetic boots that we saw everywhere and just clicking your heels together, you know, Wizard of Oz style to be able to stay on board.
Yeah, I like the design of the Martian ship. I think they did a good job setting this apart from the other things we've seen designed by Earth and designed out in the belt and stuff. So it had a certain quality to it because it also sort of established the position of technological superiority in like just even like looking at these corridors compared to, you know, Ceres Station or stuff down on Earth, etc. That this is top of the line, which even more like has already been said, drives home the point later on when it blows up that somebody else is more topper of the line stuff than this.
More topper of the line.
Yep.
The thing linear.
The thing that did that for me was the differences in the suits. Like you've got, you know, the Canterbury refugees kind of in these baggy, you know, suits. And then you've got the Mars military people in like these high tech things that like the arm of the guard suit like glows when he gets a communication, which seems kind of like a security issue, but whatever, you know, and things like that. Like it was just like sleeker and you could tell there was like a difference. And I'm sure part of that is military versus, you know, like low budget expedition thing. But that was a big tell for me too.
Yeah. I mean, we're impressed by these spaceships that we see. And it's only later that we see these. They're like, those are not that good. This is much better spaceship than the ones you've been watching here.
I like the interior design. I feel like the CGI of the spaceships and the space battles, like, I guess they're probably trying to be very strategic with it, but I don't enjoy that compared to other science fiction shows that I like. I feel like there's a ton of stuff and it's very rushed and they don't do a lot of like establishing shots and it's kind of hard to follow what's going on and everything is very, very dark. And I know space is dark, but I'm not a big fan of how the ships are...
The ship being dark?
The ships are shown in, you know, from the outside.
But Tony, they label every single scene with where you are and where they are in the solar system. How is that not clear? No, I hate that too.
Yeah, it's more the battle, like the, and you know, I mean, I guess maybe the battle where they're being attacked by the stealth ships is supposed to be confusing, but like I can't tell what's going on in any of those shots really, and maybe that's the intent, but I didn't really enjoy that.
No, I agree with Tony. It was confusing. Also, it was a little weird with the way that they chose to like split everything up and have it move like really, really super duper fast past the camera. So the bad guy ship, splits apart into, all these different components. And it's sort of a little more, fantastical than I kind of had pictured in my mind from, you know, the technology that you would assume it would be, It just seems a little more far-fetched, but it's hard to keep track of. I do appreciate they had the debris field as the battle kept going on, that there was just junk all over the place from bits of metal and stuff crumpling apart from ship explosions and I would assume ammunition. So that part was better, I think.
I thought it was most effective when we didn't see almost anything and it was the rumbling on the Martian warship, because that is, you know, especially when we're with the characters that are in the brig, they don't know what's going on and they're making guesses. I think Alex is making guesses based on the sounds of the, you know, based on the alert sounds and the rumblings and the lights.
The rail guns.
Yeah, yeah, the rail guns are firing and they're in the point
and
defense
then the
camp.
Shut off. And,
yeah, and they realize that they're boarding. I thought that that was really claustrophobic and, yeah. And like, we don't even know, we can't even see what's happening. But yeah. Bad things are happening out there.
One of my big pet peeves about TV shows is often when the audience is told information via a big sort of expository dump from one character to another, but only when it doesn't make sense because both characters know this information and the only reason that first character is telling the second character is clearly because the audience needs to know. That's why I really loved it in that particular scene because most of the people in that room who were freaking out didn't know and right. They wanted to know. So the person who was giving them that information happened to be also giving the information to the audience, but I felt like the audience part of it was secondary. So I was pleased that I wasn't being pandered to in an obvious way as an audience member.
They yeah. do that a lot on a series as well when they're establishing all the different political factions and all the people who are chanting about Remember the Cans and all of these other things about being belters and the strife between Earth, Mars, and the Belt. I thought that was fantastic too, that same kind of, we are audience members learning this for the first time, but they're not pandering to us. They're doing what they're doing and we're just watching, which is awesome.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, let's disagree. Let's come back to that. I want to button up.
I have thoughts and feelings.
The crew of the Canterbury before we get there. So Shed gets his head blown off.
That was a little gruesome. I knew it was coming, but it was a little
little blob of blood in zero G, and then the engines cut
was,
in.
That was super cool. I mean, I'm not somebody who goes searching for things that are bloody and gory, but I also don't mind them when they appear. And when it's something like this, where the first sort of close up shot when he's sealing the hole behind that, I couldn't quite tell what it was we were seeing in the foreground. I was like, are there flames shooting out of his neck? I couldn't quite tell what it was. And then we get sort of a wider shot, and I realized that it's just that little blob of blood because they're in zero G, and I was just like, oh my god, that is mind-blowingly cool. And then it splashed down and it was so gross, and I was like, yay.
The look on Alex's face when that blood, it was perfect, like when that happened. And he was just like, oh god, like that is disgusting. I was like, I'm right there with you, that is bad.
Well, I like the, you know, but they think quickly to patch the holes with like a clipboard and the operations manual or whatever, which is pretty cool. So they've got to, you know, spring into action so they don't suffocate while they're also realizing that they're not a medic. Shed has been decapitated by this, you know, passing through bit of weaponry. According to Daniel Abraham, by the way, since this, a lot of this stuff started as a role-playing game and then they turned it into a novel, the guy who played Shed couldn't make it. So they killed him. And that's why Shed dies.
I suddenly love this so much more.
I want to play the role-playing game. That sounds amazing.
I know. So one of the things that I really like about the scene, too, is that it shows how capable they are in a crisis, which, as you can imagine, for like a space battle show, which is, you know, I think it's pretty clear that's what this is going to be, right? Like, it's like, oh, okay, you know, like there are two holes in the wall. What are we going to do? You know, we're prisoners in here. Oh, binders. Binders will work. You know, that'll plug the hole well enough. So I think that that's a really good way to establish maybe kind of some of the stuff that we're going to see later on as maybe other crises happen.
When they all work together like that, there's a scene a little bit later when Holden is with the rest of the MCR soldiers, and I think, you know, I'm midway through the third book right now, and they're all so close-knit together, and there's a moment when one of the MCRN soldiers says, why do you care about these people? You're not that close. You only just met. And then I remembered, oh, right, they just met. This is the very beginning of the story. Oops. So I think a lot about, you know, that is the right kind of thing to show them working together because that could become so important later in the rest of the story.
Yeah, I mean, this episode four ends with the big moment where they get to the ship and they get out of there before the Mars naval ship gets destroyed, and you know they are solidified without spoiling what happens in the rest of this book. This is the moment where they solidify as a crew. They've lost Shed, but the rest of them have made it to this ship and they're off, and they're the only survivors of two space disasters by these unknown forces. So they're in a pretty interesting position, but it's a key moment for those characters that now we sort of have seen them arrive as who we're going to be following.
Yeah. Did anybody else think of the Hunt for Red October when the Mars guy was just like, I would have liked to have seen an ocean on Earth?
Yes.
Thinking, in Montana?
Yeah. I was just going to say, speaking of, this particular moment, there's, of course, Lopez, who's not in great shape. We hadn't really talked about his interrogation and presence on the bridge and stuff with Holden and getting him to the ship. I mostly liked him, I guess, in a way, other than his weird confrontational moment on the bridge and the fact that it didn't really make a whole lot of sense with the pill thing that he was taking for the interrogation scene.
That was weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my boyfriend was asking me, because he got sucked into watching this now, even though he hasn't read the book series, and so he's like, why did he take that thing? And it's like, did it give him, like, powers or something? And I was like, no, it's just like, he's seeing all the little twitches and movements and stuff in her face, which is why they keep doing the close-ups. But it's not as it's a little too subtle, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. So he didn't quite pick up on it.
Those scenes were beautifully shot, though, with all those close-ups.
Yeah. You could, it kind of would read better if it's like, usually when you're interrogating people, you medicate them, right? Instead of medicating the interrogator who takes it right in front of you.
But it makes you feel a little weird.
I like the shots and his little relationship with Holden. They had the nice shot where the Marine on the bridge gets like taken down by an explosion and his gun clatters and he watches Holden not go for the gun. And you know, that was nice and easy to miss, right? They do a decent amount of showing without being super explicit in your face about, you know, Holden is a good guy.
I like that they're adversarial still. I mean, I think that's interesting. It's like the Marines have this order to take them, or take Holden especially, and the order is not to take all of them. It's to take Holden and get him off the ship because he's got the information that they want to get out there. But I like that, although that's their orders, they don't like him, and they tell him so. And that's a nice dynamic. Like, look, we got the orders to take you off of here, jerk. You know, I like that. That was fun.
For me, I didn't care too much for that character, that bit of it. It felt so compressed. It all happened so fast. I didn't quite have time for all of it to sink in. And I think this is my biggest complaint about just the show in general, is that I didn't quite feel like I was on board with what was happening until about two scenes after it was done. Mm-hmm. So first he's doing the interrogation, and after a while I'm like, okay, so that's what the interrogation thing is. That's why he was taking the pill, etc. And then by then we're on the bridge, and he's mad at Holden for one thing, and he thinks Naomi's OPA, and then suddenly he's supposed to be taking Holden. You know, things are happening fast, which, I mean, if you can keep up with it, I guess that's great and exciting. But even having read the book, I keep struggling to sort of keep up with what is happening in any given scene. And I'm still having trouble understanding some of the dialogue from time to time. So that slows me down even more.
I think we should also talk about racism. Let's talk about racism.
Okay, because, let's do it.
Because that's something that we see here, right? Is like Naomi's in interrogation. The dude takes the pill. He's looking at her, and then we cut. You know, we go back to the bridge, and it's like, well, Naomi is an OPA operative. She lies the best, and like they have this preconceived notion about who she might be without. It doesn't seem like any evidence. And so I think that that's kind of starting to set, to show us, like, there's Mars, there's Earth, and there's the OPA, right? And the Belchers, OPA are Belchers, but like,
the IRA.
Right. So those biases are starting, you know, we're already seeing them. We've seen it on Earth with in episode one with the Belcher, who was like they were using gravity torture. And now we see it again in this episode with basically like, we don't know why it's Naomi. We can't tell you why, but it is, and it's not. So,
yeah.
Yeah, no, well, that's one of the things I really like about this is that you get a better sense, I think, in episode four, and part of episode three, that of the dynamics. I think early on, I saw somebody was saying how people were asking, like, who are the Martians? Are they aliens? Are they people who live on Mars? And it's like, well, no, they're people who live on Mars. But it's kind of like, especially if you haven't read the books, it's like, what are the relationships here? And through the lens of general hatred of your fellow man, through racism, we learn why people hate each other in this world. Isn't it great?
Yeah, Stephen told me, because he hasn't read the books either, that as we were watching, when he first saw the people from Mars, he expected them to be green.
Ah.
And I was like, oh,
no,
nope, not that kind of Martian.
No, they just live on Mars. Mm-hmm. It's true. But they suspect Naomi because she's a Belter, and they might have some, from the other books, I think, she does have connections in the Belt, and she does have a history that we don't know anything about. And there could be reasons that they suspect her, but in the end, they suspect her because she's a Belter, and they don't like they don't like Holden because he's an Earther, and he was in the Earth military, and they treat Alex with respect because he got dishonorably discharged, or he got honorably discharged from the Martian Navy, and that's enough. And it's like, you're one of us, you are not one of us. And that's like, this is not one of those futures, these Gene Roddenberry futures, where everybody loves each other and treats each other with respect. Yeah. This is
nobody likes anybody.
New lines have formed, and now we mistreat people based on those new lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took a little bit of speechifying to get us there. You know, we had a couple of speeches from people about, Earth people are like this, Mars folk are like that, whatever. But I was fine with that because it made it clearer to me what direction everybody was coming from. And it also helped sort of set Holden apart. He really is sort of his own maverick kind of guy because he doesn't follow the same sort of stereotypes that we get from Earth people. And he sort of sides with Belters over the people who have been stamping their boots on their necks and all that stuff. He's still not my favorite casting wise. I feel like he's kind of a poor man's Timothy Oliphant, but I'm getting there.
Let's move on to series. It came up earlier, so we should talk about it now. Thanks, Brian. You mentioned it. It's the issue of how we are to learn about information about how this world works and everybody's relationships to everybody else and the Belter patois and the OPA and things like that on series. And everybody jumped in to say that they had problems with it when Brian said that he thought it was clever.
So I liked it. Come on.
Those people should talk now.
I really struggle with it. I mean, I think it's really cool and I appreciate it in the books, but I have a really hard time basically picking up when they're transitioning into Belter patois. Like, did I not hear that line or was I not supposed to be able to hear that line? And that's really hard for me to follow, basically. And
I wonder if it would have been better with open subtitles.
Yeah.
Like just to say, no, you're not supposed to understand this, but they've made the decision to have parts of the dialogue be not understandable.
Yeah. And especially because, they do a pretty good job. It sounds like a patois in that it's like there's slang and there's some other languages mixed in there. And I recognize little bits of French and stuff. And it's like, in some ways, that just makes it harder, right? For me to follow. Like, because again, there's the question of like, are you supposed to be able to decipher what that is, or is that just flavor, right? Because it works in terms of like they've clearly built a language that works and is consistent, but presumably you don't need to understand it, but when you hear it, you want to try to understand it. And that really kind of pulls me out of following the dialogue.
Exactly. I had the same problem. If there was some way that I could be notified of when I'm not supposed to understand, that would be fine. Because even in scenes where it's characters who I'm pretty sure aren't talking in any kind of Belter patois, I still sometimes have trouble picking up what the dialogue is supposed to be because, music or sound effects or something are a little high. So if I'm not catching something that I am supposed to be knowing sometimes, then it makes it extra bad for the other times. I mean, even if they had the actual like spelled out patois words on the screen as subtitles that look like gibberish, that would at least be something.
That would help.
Like Tony, I think it's cool and it's a neat neat way to build out the universe. But I feel like, to me, it strikes me a little bit that this, especially these scenes, are sort of aimed at the person who's watching the box set, who's going to go back and rewatch and pick up on little things and cues. And I have become less and less that kind of a person as time goes on because because I only have so much time and there are so many TV shows. I just kind of want to be able to watch a show once and understand it and enjoy it. And I'm still struggling with the understanding part.
The beauty of turning on the closed captions, by the way, is when you turn on the closed captions, when you're not supposed to understand it, it just says speaking Belter Patois.
Oh, see, I don't even know if don't even remember if that if captions was a possibility. On
well,
space.com.
With a streaming, maybe not. But I did watch the iTunes version, which had of the first episode, which had the caption track, and that's what happened. Is like when they were speaking unintelligible Belter, it said speaking unintelligible Belter, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not supposed to understand that part. Yeah. But because it's hard to tell. Tony's totally right. I actually love the immersion of like being in this world. And it's like it feels so real. I don't even know what they're saying. It's like the future and it's alien. That's all great, except that your brain is like, is this dialogue that I'm missing?
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's really great world building and it really sets the scene, but it's hard to follow dialogue, right?
Yeah. Also, they have the rest of the time they're speaking in a really heavily accented English. So it's hard to tell sometimes where the patois is coming in and where the accented English is
which
stopping.
Is how people who talk that way talk, right? They drop in and out of it seamlessly, and like it's done in like a way that really works well. But yeah, but only makes it harder to follow.
Yeah,
yeah, it's way easier to do in the book.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is English, and this stopped being.
Yeah, they
English.
Italicize the words that you're not supposed to understand because it's in Belter speak, and that's okay.
The other thing is, like Miller's partner, and I can't remember his name.
Havelock,
yes, thank you. He is very obviously our stand-in for of this, right? And that kind of pulls me out, too, where I'm like, oh, okay, like they're going to explain something that I'm supposed to understand, like they're going to talk to me like I'm a kid through Havelock. And so I don't know. I don't know why in this particular instance that's a thing that I'm noticing, but I definitely am.
It's just that Havelock also seems to not, for a police officer on this station, he seems to be missing a lot of like really like fundamental level, I would assume.
Maybe that's
He's not a character, right?
Yeah.
Like he's just there to be like a cipher for us, right?
Well, yeah. They try to make him a little bit of a character where he's teaching.
They're not heavily invested in him.
He's getting his lessons in episode 3 from the hooker. He goes there to learn how to speak. But then in the end he gets run through. So
yeah. Perhaps I'm unfair to him, but I get frustrated that. I really get frustrated in this show/book with the number of characters that have names that start with the same letter. That infuriates me for some reason. That I keep getting Amos and Andy mixed up, and then Havelock and Holden mixed up. And it's like different letters. Too
Do we
many
really
characters.
Have an Amos and an Andy?
I'm sorry,
Alex.
Alex. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Amos and Alex. Yeah.
Yeah. Amos and Andy, like totally different. Speaking of your racism. Anyway.
Yeah. There you go.
Havelock also gets, we talked about, not overdoing it about book TV show divergence, but when Havelock ends up getting killed at the end of episode 3, I was like, oh, that doesn't happen in the books, but hey, they're going to do some things that are different. But in episode 4, we find out he's not really dead.
That took me by surprise as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, well, this is such a bold decision. And then by the end of it, I was just like, well, that's no longer a bold decision anymore.
It's just a decision.
Briefly a bold decision. Yeah.
Well, he still could die from his injury. We don't know.
We don't know.
He was pretty impaled.
He was super
impaled. I like how the
pickpocket
says, oh, help this cop. Help this cop. He needs help.
But that was only after she noticed he was still alive.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. I thought that was a little bit weird. Like, you're on this, literally, the space age thing. And, like, you have to shriek and run for police. Like, there's no, like, the police don't have, like, biomedical, like, sensors or implants or something, like, that reports how they're doing. Or I thought that was a little bit weird. Like,
also, like, he's missing for, like, 24 hours. And his partner's just like, I got stuff to do.
Well, yeah.
His hand terminal doesn't have GPS.
At least his partner, that's true. They should at least have GPS. I can understand not having biometric monitoring because that's, you know, this is clearly not the most futuristic-y kind of future. Everything is, you know, they're barely hanging on when it comes to air and water and that sort of thing. But for his disappearance for so long, we did actually have Miller saying something to the effect of, oh, you know, this happens from time to time. Like he does this. It's not a big deal. So he's really covering for his partner, which is kind of a nice thing. Unfortunately, covering for his partner in this case means letting him bleed out and possibly eventually die.
Yeah. Tetanus. Well,
yeah. Also, you know, there was tetanus. An enormous riot. So he should probably check up on that.
Yeah. So the other thing that is big that happens on Ceres is the Holden's broadcast has just inflamed tensions because now Mars and I guess the inner planets in general are being blamed for the Cant being blown up. We've learned in the episode one thing about air and water are very important. You know, comes to a head here where it's like, well, they just took our water and blew it up. And so there are riots and there's suspicion of people who are not from the belt, like Miller, or Miller's from the belt, but like a Havelock. And Miller is suspected because he's a cop and he wears a hat, apparently. That's enough to make him suspicious.
And he works for Earth.
He does. He works for Earth. The security contractor is an Earth corporation. So there's rioting. And
can I ask a dumb question?
Holden seems awfully dumb, right? This is the section where you're like, stupid Holden. Yeah. Yes. That message. God,
you
look what
a
doing.
Dumb question I feel like I should know the answer to from reading the books. I mean, doesn't everybody work for some kind of Earth corporation? Is that... No,
I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Okay,
I feel like everything corporation-wise starts on Earth, but then the kind of homegrown feeling of the Belters. And I may be extrapolating from the book and not the show, mm-hmm. but the homegrown feeling of the Belters and their pride at being able to survive in these really harsh conditions, and the fact that they resent everyone else for having to rely on them for air and water—that kind of stuff—is definitely more homegrown for the Belters. But everyone mm-hmm. works for some kind of Earth corporation in that everything started on Earth, however many hundreds of years mm-hmm. before when. And they start colonizing all the planets. Yeah,
like all the Earth corporations are basically the Walmarts of Ceres. Oh. But then you've got a lot of self-employed people who have their own ships and are finding their own.
Right. Well. I think you could argue that it's. I mean, this is a revolution kind of parallel. I was thinking about it in terms of like the American Revolution. That yeah, everything's sort of English, but there are the forces that are like the representation of control from the old country, and then the people who live in this place and are fomenting, you know, independence and revolt. And that is what's happening with the OPA. So, you know, Star Helix is perceived as being a tool of power by Earth to keep the Belters in line because they're the thugs. You know, they're not the Ceres police department, right? They're the Star Helix security contractor.
Security.
Which is not the same. They're not serving the public, right? They're there to maintain order as mandated by Earth.
Making sure the economic stability, not necessarily that anyone's happy or that there's justice. But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I get the feel, I don't know if this is something I just assumed or if it's like something that's stated somewhere, but I thought that like the shop owners, like there are shop owners, just like you'd have at a
sure.
mall here, you know. Who are just like independent, paying rent, mm-hmm. trying to make it.
Yeah,
and there's the brothel. I'm pretty sure the brothel's not run by Earth. I'm guessing that's like the local.
They probably
local
I don't know. Interest thing. Well, they're paying. I bet they're paying rent to Earth, right?
I'm oh, sure yeah, they sure. are.
Yeah,
right.
mm-hmm.
yeah. And there may be a franchise fee of some sort.
Yeah. their tea is heavily taxed. So,
yeah. I mean, Holden has 8 parents. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's Yeah, who knows what's going on, but there is a lot of unrest, and through it all, Miller is kind of off on his obsession, his wild goose chase to find Julie Mao. He goes into her apartment and watches her video, like voicemail or whatever it is.
That was creepy.
Yeah, wasn't it?
That's like an that investigator voice modulation doing his job,
but like the voice modulation thing.
Yeah, where it's her voice comes out. That was cool, but it was also I thought it was also creepy. But I mean, he is it is a fundamental like violation of privacy. But I mean, he's doing his job. But it is still
sort of. I mean, he's doing his illegal off the books job
that he's been told not to do, but he's still doing it. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
That is called kidnapping.
my My favorite little filmic moment there was when you see through the transparent screen of Julie Mao giving her video voicemail back to her parents about the Razorback, and in the background you see Miller hanging out there watching it. It looks like they're standing together. I thought that was a really cool foreshadowing moment for the way that, not spoiling anything, but that the investigation goes and how much Miller cares about the investigation.
I was worried you were going to say your favorite thing was the CGI hamster. So.
Oh, God, that stupid hamster.
The red eyes.
Joe, how do you feel about the CGI hamster?
Yeah, let's talk about the hamster.
I was furious.
I thought it was a stuffed animal.
Bird.
Sorry. I thought it was a stuffed animal. I don't even understand why it was there. And then it started moving, and I'm like, what is happening? Yeah. Is it a robot hamster?
How is it alive?
What is it?
Yeah.
Ask Syracusa.
That's why they gave it the little red eye that turns on. That just was confusing and didn't provide any thing of substance to the show. I really didn't think that was even worth any of the money they spent on that.
No, I don't understand it at all.
I've got to say, the way that the book is structured splits evenly between Holden and Miller, and I'm so glad they're weighing more heavily on Holden, because watching this again, I forgot how freaking bored I was by Miller's investigation throughout almost the entire book.
Well, it takes a while for him to sweep it all together, right?
I'm just bored by his whole arc about Julie Mao. It's just not interesting to me.
There's a lot that he does in the book that would not translate well to TV, where it's like he's
not
reading
at all,
emails
no.
and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, like they make it so that it's voicemails and, you know, video emails instead of reading emails.
Miller's stuff gets more interesting as it goes, but here he is just laying groundwork. And the most important thing is introducing that crew with Holden. So it is, you know, it's an understandable thing to do that. We do get Miller gets to dig around in a dead guy's leg. Looking for a memory thingy.
I was also bothered by that scene, actually, because
it went
not
longer than I thought.
Well, and not just because it's gross, but, you know, watching it and he's using all this tech and he doesn't know that there are people using tech to modify like all of these different things. Like, that was another part where I'm like, oh, they're explaining this to the audience by Miller looking like he doesn't know anything.
I'm willing to believe some of that because I feel like some of Miller's character is basically like he is the washed up cop who has not been caring for like 10 years. Right. And so he's kind of out of it and has just been like working toward retirement. And so he has there are these other people around on the police force who actually know what's going on. And now he's invested in the Mao case and he's trying to like catch up and like put in one good day of police work before it all falls apart because he's just been phoning it in for 10 years and drinking.
I don't know. Like even my relatives who don't have computers, like literally do not have computers or internet access of any sort. And these people do exist. Know that Twitter is a thing. Like he doesn't even have a vague idea. And I don't know. It's just weird. It was not believable to me that he would just have no clue at all.
Well, more importantly, the memory crypt had encrypted data on it, except for the file names.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
Was just, what?
It's computers, Joe. You wouldn't understand.
Computers are very different.
Future computers.
Secret government corporate.
Yeah. There's cyber secrets, you guys.
Yeah.
Yes. In cyber
the future,
secrets.
Computers are all made by writers, and they just work however they need them
yeah.
to.
These all look like government files. Sure.
We have two other points of view that we need to talk about. So let's go to Earth. We get more Shura Agadashlu as Avasarala, who's got the... let's see. What does she do in this? She ruins a long
childhood
friendship.
Friends, right?
Mm-hmm. By using information from the Earth ambassador to Mars. Is that right?
Yes. Well, she uses him to get him to make a call so that they can trace and see how it all works out.
Right. Which does serve the purpose, and I think you believe that she's doing it for right reasons, and it does work too, that that it establishes that Mars is just as concerned about what's going on as Earth is, which suggests strongly that Mars is not at fault for what's going on. But in doing so, she totally burns him. He's going to be persona non grata. He had dreamed of like retiring. He's gone native, basically. He dreams of retiring to Mars, and now he's never going to be allowed to go back to Mars, and doesn't trust her anymore, quite rightly. But that was one of her stories, which I thought was interesting and shows you how she's sort of willing to do whatever she feels she needs to do, even if it's ruin friendships and people's lives.
I felt like that was my favorite sort of part of these episodes. This is my favorite part of the stories so far. And I don't know if that's because I am able to easily understand what's going on and I kind of get the motivations of the characters and I didn't have any trouble understanding any of the dialogue, or if it's just because it's a female character who I'm not seeing a whole heck of a lot of cleavage from, which is a nice refreshing thing.
And she's just so awesome.
Yeah, I was also going to add, this is, I think, is probably the most interesting thing we see her do in the first four episodes, is this moment, especially the exchange between the two of them on that bench. Mm-hmm. When she brings that bottle of wine to him to sort of, you know, straighten things out, and it doesn't get straightened out. I thought that was very well acted by both parties. I thought that was really interesting to see how that unfolded. In the prior episodes, she's mostly just in meetings and stuff, and she's at her house sometimes. So I thought this, I was finally happy to see her do more on screen.
I agree. I feel like, I mean, I don't think this is the most interesting storyline for me, at least. I mean, she's a fantastic character, especially in the books. They watered her down a lot, though, but we'll save that for another show. They gave her a lot to do, but what's weird to me is that, you know, she doesn't show up until the second book. They're just giving her something to do in order to tie her into the rest of the plot. And while I love seeing her interpretation of the character, I love the scene with her and her grandson, which I thought was fantastic. More time with her and Arjun. I don't know if I like what she's actually doing in terms of what what her contribution to the overall plot is, because again, she doesn't come into the second book, so I'm still a little wary about what they're going to have her do. And we see her do stuff, but I'm not sure where they're going to go from here. And that's interesting in that, you know, we've all read at least the first book, so we know what's going to happen, but what is she going to contribute to that? That's what I'm most excited about, but I'm also a little bored by it.
Yeah,
I really like her perspective. I mean, I you know, reading the first book, you have a lot where, you know, Holden really has no idea what's going on. And that's like the kind of thing, he's like bouncing off stuff and he shows up places and everything goes to hell when he gets there. And it's like, stop going places, dude. And
Miller broadcasting is things. All the ships.
Yeah, Miller is obsessed. Yeah, stop putting out like, all right, here's who the bad guys are this time, I'm sure.
Really, really.
He'll fight them. Yeah, it's like, oh, stop listening to that guy. And, you know, and Miller's has got his obsession. But I like that through her, we get a lot more view into what's going on in the world, because the book really kind of leaves the reader in the dark until you get kind of payoff later. But for a TV show, like, I feel like you want that perspective of like, what the heck is going on?
And it's important.
Factors at play here
to the overall story. It's important. And I feel like even the authors sort of, I think this is also the authors regretting that they didn't put this perspective in the book, because they added her in the next book, right? I mean, and so here we get to see what is happening on Earth. For all this talk of like, are the Martians green and things like that, it's like, it's kind of valuable, I think, to have this perspective of what's happening back on Earth that is being affected by this. Plus, she's doing all the stuff about like, you stole the stealth technology and all that, and we know those stealth ships are out there attacking things, right? So that's a connection that's being made there. You can say, aha.
And, you know, we've got the kind of, I mean, Holden and Miller are these kind of gray characters, right? One's on Sirius and one is just floating around in space. And there is like this idea of like, you know, there's all this revolution going on. And is it like, well, is Earth evil? And it's like, the answer is it's complicated. So it's nice to have somebody who's like, who's part of that, who is not like a villain just rubbing their hands together and cackling. And it's like, you know, there's a big government and there's probably some not good stuff happening, but you know, we see that perspective gives us more of a world, as opposed to just, you know, Earth is this evil force that's causing all this bad stuff to happen that everyone is reacting to.
It's just two unreliable narrators are almost worse than one.
Yes.
I haven't read any more than the first book, so this is my only introduction to this character. And so I think maybe it's kind of interesting that she's my favorite, and that's the part of the story I like the best, is the part that wasn't even in the book.
I like her even more in the book, I think.
Me too.
She's a little saltier in the book.
A little. Yeah, just slightly.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they don't have her even mildly swearing, although perhaps there is a moment building that we're building to. I don't know there, but I think juxtaposing her stuff on Earth with also the attitude of the Martians, there's that scene where they say basically like, Earth is old and dead and isn't going to go anywhere, but Mars is the future, man. We're making things happen. I think that those give you a lot of perspective on what the inner solar system is all about. And, you know, and the story is, Earth is huge and has all these people on it, but, you know, Earth is just Earth. It's content mm-hmm. to sort of sit at the bottom of its gravity well, and mm-hmm. it's not out in space doing, you know, it's just exerting its power elsewhere.
And she has that lovely interchange with her buddy. I forget if it's from the book where it's like, you know, Mars is turning, you know, a desolate rock into a garden, and on Earth we just pave the garden over.
Yeah.
Yeah, Martians dream. I thought that was a great line that they dream.
I think it's interesting because, like, with her, I noticed some things that they seem to be pulling forward and foreshadowing. And I think that they're doing the same thing with some of Naomi's later character development and revelations, where they're kind of starting to already pull some threads through. And I don't know if that's for just little stuff that is likely to happen later, unless this goes totally Game of Thrones on us. And so I'm wondering how much is, you know, for rewatch and for people like me who are like, oh yeah, I know, you know, you're talking about this thing and, oh, this thing's going to happen later that really correlates with that. And so it's going to be interesting to see how they weave all of these things together. Sorry, that sounds really incoherent, but the people who have read the books, I hope, will understand what I'm talking about.
No, I get that. I get that.
I totally understand what you mean, especially after reading the most recent stuff. There were a few moments where I was like, I got that wink. I'm pretty sure that probably has a lot to do with they've written so much now that they can be like, oh, hey, that was a good idea. We should probably mention that.
Yeah,
now that we know where we're going.
Bring her back.
Yeah.
The other thing that we get a new perspective in episode 4, which is on Tycho Station. Fred Johnson is talking to a representative of the Mormon Church who is going to fire him as the project manager until he points out that he controls the unions, essentially. And it's a nice ship you've got there that we're building for you. It'd be a shame if anything would happen to it. They're building the huge Nauvoo in order to launch it to another star over the course of many generations. We don't get a lot with this, although we definitely get the sense that Fred is the power broker here. In this part of the outer part of the solar system, and they're turning he orders the sensors, the Nauvoo cleared, so that they can repoint the sensors on the ship or the radios or whatever it is to where the Doniger is, but or was, as it turns out. Because it's about to get blown up. So that's another. This is a major character that we see for the first time here, we also get that little bit of color about. We saw the Mormon missionaries in an earlier episode on Ceres, mm-hmm. and that was a nice sort of lead in to the fact that you know, not only are the Mormons out there in space, but they're building a giant spaceship.
Yeah, I
appreciate that they're seeding all of these different things in, but until they start to come together, they just seem a little weird and disjointed. Having not read any of the books, Stephen was a little confused about that first, that one very, very short Fred Johnson scene. He was like, that was kind of a weird thing, that one guy that they just introduced very briefly and then it didn't go anywhere else. If that had happened at the beginning of another episode where he appears more, I think it would have flowed a little better. As it was, mm-hmm. I fear that by the time we get around to watching episode 5, Stephen will have forgotten all about this guy.
Yeah, I have to agree, because when I was watching it with Jason, he totally did not pick up on what was happening at all. He's like, why are there Mormons in space? And I was like, there's a little more explanation in the book, but we'll just ignore that part. And then he's like, oh, so he's the bad guy, right? And I'm like, no, let's pull it back. I think
it depends upon your perspective, really.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like it was disjointed, and I totally agree with Erica. And if you were a new viewer, I don't know how you would necessarily pick up on how this is supposed to make you feel about Fred Johnson going forwards, since that was it. But
it was kind of a weird introduction to him.
Yeah, so there's I agree. That guy, and then we don't see him again. I like that point that. For me, as a book reader, I'm like, enter the new character, but he's only really got the one scene. So would it not be better to have that be something that happens early in an episode where he's got other stuff to do? So mm-hmm. so it can stick in our minds instead of being just this little, I mean, again, I would say, and I think this goes back to our first episode too, and it's come up tonight. lots of things in this feel like this is a Netflix style series. A lot of this stuff feels like, you know, this is meant to be watched binged. In a binge. Yeah. Much more than it's meant to be watched parceled out over a week at a time, because some of this stuff like makes more sense if it's compressed. But instead, you know, it's not. It's a linear TV show. It's going to, you know, you're going to watch episode 4 and then wait a week for episode 5.
Yeah, and the episodes don't feel particularly episodic. It's just, it's so serialized, it might as well be a soap opera without separate names for each episode, because they just really run one into the next,
I think the structure is that they are structured plot-wise to have a cliffhanger at the very end of each. And true. I think that might be one of the reasons why episode 2 is so boring, is because they know where they want episode 2 to end, and then they stretch that story, whereas episode 3 and 4 feel compressed to me because they have a lot of story to tell. Like episode 4, or when they get one of my favorite things in the book is there is a huge scene that is full of tension about how they get through that shuttle bay to the shuttle, and it's done in, you know, 45 seconds or maybe a minute and a half in this episode. And that's because they chose, probably partly because of budget and partly because they chose to emphasize the sort of like action in the hallways instead of in the shuttle bay. But it led me to feel like the pacing was weird, because episode 2 is pretty slack and episode 3 and 4 are really packed. And I think it is because they've chosen these moments of cliffhangeriness to structure every episode around, which I suppose that you could argue that is a Netflix kind of thing to do, because it's the thing that gets you to watch the next episode. But, you know, I think it actually distorts some of the episodes, because, like I said, I think that's one of the reasons episode 2, fittingly called The Big Empty, by the way.
But, you know, just having a spot where you have a cliffhanger doesn't necessarily make it an episodic structure. It just means that there happens to be a cliffhanger.
Well, I mean, Game of Thrones is a great example. As opposed to The Wire, which just ends and they're like, yeah, screw you. You're going to watch the next one. We don't care. Something like Game of Thrones, it's completely non-structured of like a bunch of continuing storylines, but something exciting happens at the end to make you go, oh, that was interesting. And then you have to come back the next week.
Well,
so
that's like,
the structure,
you know,
here.
Game of Thrones has 50 storylines, so they've always got something that would be exciting at the end of an episode. So far, at least, we've only got, what, now 4?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I get that, but at least in The Expanse, as compared to Game of Thrones, I've never seen The Wire, but at least compared to Game of Thrones, they the plots are much more interconnected. After Holden makes the broadcast, you get a lot more, like, everyone else is talking about the broadcast, and things start to bleed over between stories much more than in Game of Thrones, where everyone is so separate except for a few key moments. This one definitely has more of an overarching plot in terms of everything happening at the same time.
It is very clear by the end of episode 4. Even that scene with Fred Johnson, because he says point the things at the Doniger, everything here is connected. It's very clear that everything is connected, because you've got Holden causing riots and you've got Julie Mao being investigated, and he finds out that Miller finds out that the ship that she was on is the ship that Holden and his people were investigating when the Cant got blown up. And Avasarala is talking about the stealth technology and how Mars is reacting because they didn't do it. And then and there's that Fred Johnson scene. So it's all connected in a way that, yeah, Game of Thrones a lot of times is like, so is she ever going to meet anyone else, or is it just her and the dragons for a while and the horse people? Right. That is an advantage to this, is that these storylines are a little more connected.
I do appreciate when they start to tie things together, and I think for me that's part of why I've been enjoying it more as it's gone on. Not so much because I thought episode 2 was boring, but because it still felt disjointed to me. And the closer things come together and the more tied in they become, the more invested I am. And I feel like the Avasarala part is, as you said, like it's what's tying things together. That's sort of the glue or the mortar in between all of the rest of these that's giving me a little bit of context. So maybe that's another reason why that's my favorite part, because I feel like it's the frame of the puzzle.
Yeah. We're all still stunned that that Brian hasn't seen The Wire, but then we just discovered also that, like, most of
nobody
the people here.
Nobody else has either.
just me and Tony.
People I used to fear or respect.
I saw a couple. I saw like three or four episodes of the first season, I think.
Well, if that's true, Erica, then you know, and Tony knows what I'm talking about here. The Wire the episodes just end, and I've said this before on podcasts that the ritual we had when watching The Wire is that either I would turn to my wife or my wife would turn to me at the end of an episode and go, so. I guess that's the end of that episode because they just end because David Simon doesn't care. You'll come back next week, people, or don't. Whatever.
He's got a show that's 10 hours, and he's just gonna, you know, however he needs to slice
it's,
that.
It's HBO. Cut it up
based on the networks,
like.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if it's more important for something like The Wire, that was a serialized week by week show, to have cliffhangers so people come back after a week, or if it's more important for Netflix style shows, you can just watch the next episode of immediately to have cliffhangers.
It's like, a good question.
Where's the motivation there?
Nobody actually watched The Wire when it was on.
The Wire.
Internet nerds had to tell everybody to yell at you to watch it and like shove a DVD case into your hands until you watched it. That was what they were
That's actually on. Why I never watched
this,
it.
This would be Glenn Fleischman is agitating for a topic episode of The Incomparable. This is actually would be an interesting one, is exploring this a little bit more. My guess is that the difference between the two is for a binge show, you don't need to have each individual episode be super fulfilling because you just want to pull people along to the next one. Whereas for a TV show that's on once a week, I feel like you need to feel like it's a satisfying meal, basically, because you only get the one and you have no option for any more of them. So it better, you know, you better not go through like what we've been talking about with episode 2 of The Expanse, where it's like, wow, that was really not, there was not a lot there. And yeah, 3 and 4 are great, but you know, your judgment for a week is, oh, that show, you know, it let me down last week. And there's a little less pressure of that if you're streaming, I think, because there's always the next one. If there's an exciting cliffhanger, like, yeah, okay, next one, woo!
I wonder, go ahead.
Who would like
to
wonder
first? What are you wondering, Joe?
Yeah. I wonder. So with this episode 2, the way it was, they basically dumped 3 and 4... along with it right after episode 2 aired. I wonder if they knew it was kind of boring and were hoping that maybe people would continue on to watch the streamed episodes. But I also wonder how many people might have been turned off by the way episode 2 went. I don't know.
We were wondering the same thing.
Yeah. My theory is that this is the last episode dump that they're going to do, where they release multiple things at the same time. I think they wanted to get people hooked with the first 4 episodes, and then you watch every week because at this point people are hooked enough that they want to keep watching.
Yeah, I think that was their strategy.
This would be a good point at which to hook people, right? Like the cliffhanger ending of 4 is kind of a big deal, right? Like this is like kind of episodes 1 through 4, I feel, are like the first big chunk, and like now it really takes off.
Yeah, so. We've been picking it apart a little bit, but I got to say, as we start to wrap this up, I was super excited after I watched 3 and 4 back to back, and I was really excited by them. I thought they were really really good, and by the end, I really wanted to watch the rest of them and was unable to do so. But I was I was excited by episode 1, episode 2. Not. And then 3 and 4 kind of rebuilt my enthusiasm for it. So if the goal of streaming those episodes was to get people excited about the show, it worked on me, because after episode 4, I definitely wanted to see a lot more and was sad because I had jumped ahead. I skipped ahead by watching the streaming versions and knew there was not going to be another episode until January. Boo.
I'm going to continue watching for 2 reasons, and neither of those are because I'm super enjoying it. The first reason is because I get to come and talk to you guys about it, which I think helps me understand a little better what's going on where I still struggle. And the second reason is because Steven, my spouse, is actually enjoying it kind of even more than he expected to. And it's so rare to find a new TV show these days that he enjoys. So I'm just having fun watching him enjoying a television show for a change. strange. So for my own part, I'm still, and a lot of the reason that I'm still kind of iffy is I think just in my own head, struggling to separate what vague little memories I have of the book from what I'm seeing on the screen. So like I said, the farther away from that I can get, I think the better I'll like it. But I still think that, you know, an episode finishes and Stephen will say, you know, I don't really feel like I know what's going on in a lot of it, but I'm still enjoying it enough to keep watching. And I feel like I'm having a little trouble myself even having read the first book. And I think I would be even more lost if I hadn't read the first book. So that's why I'm kind of on the fence, but it's still pulling me along.
Well, and I think too that we're gonna get out of the world building, the universe, the expanse building a little bit more pretty soon, and it'll kind of smooth out a little bit. But there's a whole lot that they have to kind of front load to set up for anything else to make sense later on. So hopefully it's just kind of like they're like, okay, you're just gonna have the steep learning curve, and then it'll kind of flatten out.
But well, what Game of Thrones did, which is good, except with only 10 episodes and we're almost halfway through.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like soon, like the next couple of episodes, that'll happen without like.
You mean like 60% of the way through the series?
Yeah, but you know, like this episode, I think will be smoother.
Well, what Game of Thrones did in its first season was really front load things, and I remember the first three episodes were all front loading exposition, get everything out of the way, and then I remember the fourth episode, something happened that was like, oh, now the show trusts its audience to know what's up and figure out what's going on, who these characters are, and why these little moments that they almost gloss over but focus on enough, like, you know why those are important, and The Expanse needs to get to that point pretty soon.
I can see that. I mean, I think it's a tough balancing act of world building and giving people enough action and excitement that they, because you don't want to just watch world building. That's really boring.
Unless you're the kind of person who just likes reading through the role-playing game guide to The Expanse and just being like, ooh, that's cool.
Yeah, you buy the book.
Show me a map of OPA.
That's it. You buy the book, and the first thing you do is you look at the map, and the next thing you do is you look at the appendix. You might get to the book, but really it's about the map and the appendix.
Show me some stats tables.
How's everybody else feeling about the show after four episodes?
I'm more optimistic by the end of four than I was feeling from one and two. I think that one did not super duper excite me a whole bunch, and two was, as we've all discussed, a disappointment. Three was an improvement over one and two, four, the best so far. So if they just keep going on that trajectory, it'll certainly make me happier. Like Erica said, it turns out that it is a show that my boyfriend watches, so it's kind of interesting to watch with him, although it does kind of limit when I can watch it. But at least I'm not watching like tiny house shows, because that just makes me crazy. but that is also interesting too, because I also get to sort of participate in this with somebody who hasn't seen it and get to see what questions he asks that I'm kind of wondering about myself as I watch it, where I'm like, structurally, how did they put this together where it makes sense? Like, does this make sense? And then, you know, I hear him like 2 seconds later ask me, you know, why did they do this or that or the other? So then that also helps me process the episode as I'm watching it.
If I can make it through True Detective season two, I can make it through anything. So I'm sticking it throughout this one.
Wow, that is not an endorsement.
Okay, let me clarify. I'm having enough fun that I'll stick around, but you're right. I was not impressed by the first episode, especially because, you know, we got that however many weeks in advance. And I was like, yay, great, my favorite book series is now this TV show that I'm going to watch the pilot of. Okay, they did it. They adapted it into a one episode. That's cool. And it was enough to get me hooked on, you know, 2, 3, 4, which was very strategic of them. And now I'm just going to ride it through because it's fun enough. I'm liking it.
Any other verdicts out there?
Lean. I really liked the first episode. I didn't like the second episode. I thought like 3 and 4, I don't know. I think I'm just waiting for everything to kind of coalesce and for the people I love to be the people I love, if that makes sense. Which is a huge disadvantage to reading the books, I think, is it's like I'm waiting for the parts I like. And then all of this exposition, I'm just kind of like slogging through. So that's part of why I'm like, yeah, no, it's going to be there soon. But I'm still really optimistic about it. I think that it's going to be good, and I'm looking forward to finishing out the season.
All right. Well, we will, I think we will reconvene at some point. Like I said at the beginning, I don't think we're going to do every episode because that is crazy. And I do that enough already. But I think we'll bring the panel back once or twice more this season. We'll try to check in on the Expanse. If not, if not in 3 or 4 weeks, then maybe at the end of the season, we'll come back and talk about it. But I'm excited, and I will keep watching. And then for those of you who are catching up because you're binge watching this from the future, I envy
Hello,
you.
Hello, future.
Congratulations, and I hope the jumpsuits and jetpacks are awesome. All right. Thanks to my panel, Erica Ensign. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for giving me a reason to watch some new science fiction.
Yeah, it's fun, and you get to watch it with your husband and use him as a test case, which works so well on the audio guide to Babylon 5 that it's nice True. To do that again. And Joe Steele, thank you for being here. You also get the test case scenario, which is fun. I have that too. It is fascinating, book readers and non-book readers watching a show together. It's weird.
I feel like we should probably all have clipboards when we sit there and watch this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Oh, how did that make you feel? What do you think is going to come next? I mean, that moment when my wife was like, when the Canterbury blew up, and she's like, oh, I thought the show was about that. Like, nope. Nope. What else did you think? What are your opinions about Halton today? Well,
what is this? Some sort of a tale of Canterbury's? No. So.
Oh, Joe.
Aww.
Get out, Joe.
Yeah. Brian Hamilton, I'm sorry you had to hear that.
It was fun. I can't convince anyone to watch with me, so if anyone in the, I guess, I don't know, East Coast, where am I living now? If anyone on the East Coast wants to watch The Expanse with me, go right ahead.
Right.
Just let yourself in.
That's right.
Just show up.
Brian's leaving the door open a crack. You just do the little knock and then come on in. Tony Sindelar, thank you for being here.
I always like talking about space.
Yay, space. And Aline Sims, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this Expanse edition of the TV podcast. I have been Jason Snell. I will continue to be so into the future. Woo! We'll see you next time.